Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
All right, so Wall Street is quietly ending an era. Yesterday, the Financial Times reported that two partners at Goldman Sachs, who helped lead the so-called quantitative investment movement on Wall Street, have left the firm following large losses at their marquee fund, their hedge fund known as Global Alpha, which declined precipitously during the credit crisis. Really, the last generation on Wall Street has been a triumph for program traders, for computer geeks, and particularly mathematicians who invented new algorithms and ways of creating, packaging, and tracking stocks and all kinds of investments throughout the globe. Michael Osinski is a former Wall Street computer programmer. He has a piece in the current New York Magazine, which really talks about the story of how he wrote the software that allowed traders to so-called securitize mortgages, turn them into bonds and securities. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for calling.
And you are, I guess I'm tempted to say, you know, hell of a job, Michael. Thanks for doing that. But no. It's not all your fault, right?
No, I don't think it's all my fault. But, you know, everybody that many thousands of people were involved in the business. And then on the other end, hundreds of thousands of people were taking out loans. So, you know, it's a more of a cultural phenomenon.
Well, let's talk about the culture. Did the culture of Wall Street change, and did the math and programming guys and gals become the leaders driving the financial markets, or was it more of a, you know, standing on the sidelines?
Well, I mean, as a programmer, you were never, you know, on the you were never the prima donnas, right? You were always sort of in the background. And then culturally, you know, I came to Wall Street in '85, and the influence of computers was growing, you know, exponentially during from 85 to 2000 when I left. And then when you take mortgages, you need to have computers. You could not trade mortgages. You couldn't create the securities without computers. You need databases to track all the mortgages in the country. You need models to predict defaults, models to predict prepayment rates. And then you need models just to do the bundling, which is what I did. I would take the raw mortgages and then convert them into a network of bonds, keeping both of them in balance.
Now, one of the lessons from this crisis is that there is a point, and the threshold isn't altogether predictable, but there's a point where you get away from the sort of face-to-face relationship of I'll lend you this money, you promise to pay me back kind of trust element, that suddenly it's almost impossible to value the security. How, first of all, can you deal with that mathematically, and where do you think the threshold is?
Well, you know, securitization grew after the S&L crisis because banks were issuing loans and thrifts and holding them, and that was, you know, not untenable, right? They were going under, if you recall,
sure,
late 80s, early 1990s. So securitization was a means to solve that problem or ameliorate the problem. As you know, now you could, the bank could issue the loan, but then he could sell it off, so he didn't have the long-term risk of whether the rates went up or down. Now, of course, that did alleviate, you know, the small banker from the small lender kind of situation. So that did sort of pave the ground for mortgage brokers to go out and just canvass the world. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but was, you know, four or five years ago, the phones used to ring off every day. Hey, you need a new mortgage, refi. I mean,
sure.
It was bothering everybody. There was a huge demand. There was a demand from the investors, and so it was a conduit that was built that was, you know, successful for a while, but it definitely got out of control. I mean, the culture changed. You know, the people that were issuing shouldn't have issued to people who couldn't, who had a hard time making that note. They had some confusing, you know, rates on mortgages. And then, you know, the culture changed. That people, when I was a child, having a second mortgage was considered as much of a disgrace as being divorced.
Exactly. Well, you know, an old-fashioned banker from the central bank in Lebanon a guy who doesn't get a bonus and has a fixed salary, told us on this program about a week ago that he prohibited banks from getting involved in these securitized mortgages, that he thought they were a bad idea going in, that if you can't see the person that you're borrowing to or lending to, that the whole thing is worthless. Is he brilliant or is he just old-fashioned?
I think old-fashioned. And, you know, people, all bankers should, you know, instead of trying to make short-term profits, they have to, you know, you have to have a 30-year horizon. Well, nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow. Nobody. I don't care what model you have. And so who knows what's going to happen in 30 years? So your only recourse, only sane recourse, is to be extremely conservative.
Well, from Greenport, Long Island, where you are now an oyster farmer, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, there is life after Wall Street. Any pearls out there in the oysters?
No, these are bred to be fast growers, get to the plate in a year and a half, 2.5 years.
Well, after he designed the programs to help securitize mortgage, he's currently an oyster farmer on Long Island. Michael Lisinski, former Wall Street computer programmer, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
His piece is in the current New York Magazine about how he programmed our way, in part, to a financial disaster. Mike Garrison joins us now with the headlines.
Thank you. Coming up on 29 minutes after the hour.